Welcome to Gospel Truth with Andrew Womack. Today, Andrew explores America's godly heritage with special guest David Barton. And now, here's Andrew.
Welcome to our Monday's broadcast of the Gospel Truth. Again this week, I've got a very special series of programs that we're doing. We have my guest David Barton here with us, and this is our second week of programming with him. And I tell you, what a blessing he's been. I've looked forward to these programs, and they have not disappointed me. And what we're doing is basically discussing American history and the godly influence on it. And again, I want to make this point that this is not limited to the United States, even though we are using primarily as our focus, you know, the godly heritage of America. But this applies to you wherever you are. We're really talking about the influence of God on government and the relationship between Christians and their involvement in government. And I tell you, we've brought out some tremendous truths last week. Real quickly, let me just summarize some things that we talked about, that there is a belief among many people that they're, you know, today they're saying that basically our founding fathers were secularists, they were humanists, that there wasn't a godly influence, and they're using that to get away from religion having anything to do with government and a total separation of church and state. And David spent quite a bit of time this last week debunking that and showing that the phrase separation of church and state, what was the phrase that you used? It was more accurate to say
secularization of church and state.
Secularization. And it was never intended to get religion out of the public thing. And so anyway, we've debunked this. We've gone into a lot of historical documents and have shown that our founding fathers, 95%, I think is what David said, are by and large, I mean, committed Christians, and never, by their own example, never intended for prayer to be taken out of public schools, to get away from our godly heritage. And so we've dealt with all of these things. And anyway, at the end of the programs last week, we basically came to this point where if this is true, and if these are the roots, and if this is the foundation, and it's very obvious by all of the documentation that you provided, how did we move away from such a godly thing? And basically, we were just beginning to touch on that you felt like that the church quit making scriptural application to everyday life, and when confronted with evolution, and you mentioned, what was it, in the 1920s?
The repeal of Prohibition, and then the Great Depression.
And the Great Depression was attributed to Hoover, who was very highly endorsed by Christians of his day, Billy Sunday and others. And these things made Christians kind of retreat back into the church and out of the public arena. So you're saying basically that the church was the first one to drop the ball and quit applying the word to our daily life.
There's no question that America does not exist as a nation were it not for the church. And the other thing that we've allowed ourselves to happen with Christianity is we've allowed Christianity to be defined primarily as a theological belief system. And the founding fathers were very adamant that, yes, it is a theological belief system, but it is also a societal living system. That's why someone like Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, who might not be a personal Christian, were huge advocates of Christianity and biblical teachings because of what they did in a culture. I mean, quite frankly, if you take something as simple as the Ten Commandments, from a societal standpoint, you know, I really don't care if my neighbor is an atheist. Now, as a Christian, I do. But sure, from a societal standpoint, I don't care if he's an atheist. But you know what? If he'll obey the Ten Commandments, if he won't kill me and steal from me and take my wife, he makes a great neighbor. Mm-hmm. And that was the benefit of those teachings. If you take those biblical teachings, if you ignore anything in the future, any kind of heaven or hell or anything, and just say, live by these teachings, they will change the course of a country. So it's out of biblical Christianity that we have what's called republicanism, that people elect their own leaders at local, county, state, and federal levels. It's out of Christianity that we have the rights of conscience protected. Under Christianity, we believe in free market religions. We don't chase other religions off. We say, hey, come on. We're like Elijah on top of prophets of Mount Baal, on top of Mount Carmel, the prophets of Baal. Take all the time you want, but I just get my time. And when I get my time, we'll see who the real God is. We weren't scared of them. Joshua said, choose who you're going to serve. I'm going to choose the Lord, but choose. So we were not coercive. We were non-coercive. We were very much rights of conscience. We very much protected so many societal aspects. And that all came from Christianity. And now we're being told, and I mentioned last week that I've been involved in several cases of the U.S. Supreme Court, including Ten Commandments cases. And the reason we've had trouble displaying Ten Commandments is that the court, particularly Justice Stevens, says, well, the Ten Commandments represent a great theological dispute. Well, no, they don't. I mean, they are behavioral. That's why they hang in courtrooms and not church houses. They don't hang in churches because they're not theological. They hang in courthouses because they're behavioral. And so Christians have allowed themselves to be defined into what you believe is theological. Therefore, keep it yourself, keep it in the four walls of the church. No, what I believe affects the quality of education. What I believe affects the quality of a neighborhood, the life that goes on around me. If I will live by the Good Samaritan, if I'll live by the Golden Rule, other teachings of Jesus Christ will elevate a society. And that's part of what's happened is the church has stopped preaching in a lot of areas that are out there. And we've really gotten into a really small area. And we preach salvation, we preach heaven and hell, but we don't preach the aspect of living. And 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 says not only do we have an inspired scripture, but it says that it may prepare the man of God for every good mm-hmm. work.
Well, let me be the devil's advocate here for just a second. So you hear people say, but you can't legislate morality. What makes your morals superior to somebody else's morals?
There's several answers to that. And by the way, I hear a lot of Christians tell me, well, you can't legislate morality. And my response is, well, you better tell God that because he did it right off the bat. I mean, the Ten Commandments are a legislation of morality.
But, you know, I could even argue that point separate from the Bible because mm-hmm. you have to have some standard. I mean, the people who
That's
sit here and say you can't legislate morality, well, then why do we draw the line at being a pedophile or bestiality?
That's
somewhere you say something is right and something is wrong, and it needs to be a fixed position instead of something that's constantly moving.
That's right. And Founding Father John Witherspoon said, consider morality as conformity to a law. So we say it's 55 is a speed limit. What we're saying is it's moral to drive 55 or below. It's immoral to drive 55 or above. Mm-hmm. We say no double parking. What we're saying is it's immoral to double park. And so morality is conformity to law in general. To say you cannot legislate morality means you should have no laws at all, which puts you in anarchy.
Yeah, and you know, there's people today with the Islam religion, they're trying to bring the Sharia law in. Ooh. And there's a man who actually, an owner of a television station, that beheaded his wife and claimed that law.
That's right.
And so are they saying that we can't legislate that that's wrong?
The better question is not can you legislate morality, but whose morality are you going to legislate?
I think that that's it.
Because you will legislate somebody's morality, whether it's Sharia law, whether it's secular law, whether it's whatever. You will legislate somebody's. So why not legislate from a proven morality that has shown itself to it's really interesting. There is a book that came out in 1752 called The Spirit of the Laws by Charles Montesquieu. And Charles Montesquieu took 1,000 years of world history. He looked at every major world religion, and he says, this is the societal product of that religion. He says, where you have Islam, you have despotism, you have monarchy, you have theocratic governments, the people have no rights. He said, where you have Catholicism, he says, you tend to have monarchs because you have a single ruler over all. He said, where you have Protestant, Biblical, Reformation, Christianity, the people rule, and the people are in control. So you have, he said, Republicanism goes with Protestantism. He said, with Catholicism goes monarchy. And he said, with Islam or with Muslim goes tyranny and despotism and theocracy.
Now, there's people just all around the world being upset, but this is a historical
fact. That's historical fact.
But they don't want to face fact. They have a paradigm that they're going to believe regardless of what facts are.
And so if you're going to say, why should we legislate morality, let me give just an example. We, in the last presidential administration, really made a big push for faith-based programs. We used to have those in America all the time. But they have, when the court came out with the separation church and state nonsense that it did, which really meant secularization church and state, it's like, oh, no more faith-based programs. So the previous president made a big issue out of doing something with it. Now, what we can do is we can statistically show the difference. For example, every state in the United States, all 50 states, have state prison systems. In addition to that, we have federal prison systems. I've been on the consultant pool of the U.S. Justice Department for a number of years. Can tell you that in the prisons in America, whether run by a state or run by the federal government, the recidivism rate is 68%, which means when we let somebody go, within 2 years, 68% will commit a crime that puts them back in prison. We now have 14 or 15 states that have faith-based prisons. Okay. In those states with a faith-based prison, the recidivism rate is 8%. Yeah. as opposed to 68%. That's 85% better.
I heard Chuck Colson making that exact point on Mike Huckabee's program
night
recently.
And see, the point of that is all right, if I can reduce prison return by 85%, I need 85% fewer police officers, 85% fewer courts, 85% fewer prisons, 85% fewer prison guards. That's going to drop my taxes on justice areas 85%. Hey, if I'm an atheist, I want faith-based programs because they produce something better. That's Christian morality. So let me change it. It's not Christian morality. It's biblical morality. It's Judeo-Christian morality. The biblical morality given in the Scripture makes that on something else. You take something like drugs. The government drug rehab programs, the average cure rate is less than 20%. Faith-based drug rehab programs, Teen Challenge, over 70%. Now, that's a massive difference. 25% of all crimes committed in this nation are committed by people attached to drugs who are committing crimes to get money to feed their drug habit. So if we drop that by 60%, we've now dropped crime another significant.
Let me. I got this quote from you, and you can expound on it, but Benjamin Rush said, if we cease to teach Bible in schools, we will expend much time and money in punishing crime instead of preventing it.
Yeah.
Now that, I was trying to write quick. I may not have got it exactly
word for word. That's it. Benjamin Rush was a founding father who signed the Declaration. He was considered one of the three most notable founding fathers. John Adams said, you got George Washington, you got Ben Franklin, and Benjamin Rush. We don't have a clue who the guy is today. Benjamin Rush, just to credential him a little bit, signed the Declaration, but he also started the first abolition society in America. So really started the modern civil rights movement. He also, as a white guy, started the first black denomination in America, the AME denomination. He also is called the father of American medicine. He found medical cures we still use today. He is the father of psychiatry. The American Psychiatric Association has his picture on the logo of their letterhead. He was a ratifier of the Constitution. He was the director of the U.S. Mint under three different presidents. He's a financial expert.
How do you remember all this stuff, Dave?
Because I'm so
your heart is
guys.
Really into
I,
it.
I love it,
it.
Because I see that and
that's
say,
amazing.
Why can't we be like that? You know, why is it that we're content with mediocrity? Why are we content to be so much less than what we could be? And I'll just give you an example. John Quincy Adams, founding father, president of the United States.
First vice president.
You take his diaries and read his diaries.
That was John Adams.
John Adams, first vice president. This little book here was done by President John Quincy Adams. This little book shows 10-year-old Americans how to read through the Bible from cover to cover once a year. Now, when's the last time we've had an American president show 10? I mean, we want adults to read through the Bible from cover to cover once. We're teaching our 10-year-olds to do that, and a president is doing that? What's cool about him is he would sit down on Sundays, and he says in here, I read 4 to 5 chapters of the Bible every morning, first thing. But on Sundays, he really got into more of it. And I have records of him on Sunday where that he would, one Sunday, he was really, really ticked in his diaries because the preacher only preached 45 minutes. And he thought, that's a waste of time. He said, I want a 2-hour sermon. I don't want these 45.
He said, well, he'd have loved me.
Oh, well, see, he wanted content, and they wanted content. But he would go home on Sunday afternoons, and he would start reading the Bible. And when you read his diary, he kept a diary for 68 years. He started a diary when he was 11 years old. He kept it till he died at the age of 79. And there was 24 years where he never missed a day's entry in his diary. And instead of just saying, got up at 8:30, went to bed at 9, he would have 8, 10, 12, 14 pages of what went on, what he was thinking, who he met with, what they said. And so on Sunday afternoons, you'll be reading him. And he says, well, I was reading in Romans 8 today, and it looks like the French translation out of the Greek is much better than the German translation, although the Russian is not that bad, but the Italian, he reads the Bible in 7 languages. No, and he's self-taught. Now, why don't we do that? We can.
Well, we're too busy watching MTV or whatever.
We're watching all sorts of other stuff, and we don't focus the way that they focus. And that's why Benjamin Rush is such a cool guy. But that educational quote you read, he's called the father of public schools under the Constitution. The guy started 5 universities, and 3 of them are still going today. So he is a huge educator. But when he was called the father of public schools for writing he did in 1790 as a founding father, saying, all right, now we have the Constitution, so let's look at our school system. In 1791, he did a second major educational piece, National Schools, And in it, in the first one, by the way, he said the only reason, you'll love this, he said the only reason we need public schools is because there may be some American children among us who don't know the Bible. He said, and America can't survive if it doesn't know the Bible. That's why we have public schools.
And today, if you do know the Bible and go to public school, you get it drilled out of you.
Get out. So that was his first paper in 1790. In 1791, his second paper was The Use of the Bible in Schools. He gave a dozen reasons we would never take the Bible out of schools. And in really kind of a prophetic moment, because he was looking, he's so wise, he's looking ahead, he said, I wonder if a future generation of Americans might take the Bible out of schools. Nah, they're too, well, they might. And in looking at that, that's where he said that. He said, in contemplating the political institutions of the United States, he said, if we were ever to remove the Bible from schools, I lament that we would be wasting so much time and so much money and punishing crime and taking so little pains to prevent crime.
Yeah.
And that's what
and
our faith-based
program proved. And that is prophetic. It's exactly where we are.
We took it out, and we had a 694% increase in violent crime when we took the Bible out of schools June the 25th of 1963. It's gone up 694%.
Now, are you talking about when they kicked the prayer out? Is that when that was?
Prayer was taken out in 1962 in Engle versus Vitale. And within 12 months later in 63, in two cases, Abney Shimp and Murray Curlett, the court said, oh, by the way, while we're at it, not only no prayer, but no Bible either. So in 63, we took the Bible out. And by the way, this book right here contains the very first public school law passed in America. It's from 1647. And that public school law passed in 1647, and the name of this book is called The Code of 1650. So this was done, the 1650 compilation of the laws, and that was passed in 1647. But in the law that they have in 1647, the law is actually called the Old Deluder Satan Law.
Oh, yeah.
Now, why would you call a public school law the old? Because they explain in the law, they said it's the chief project of that old deluder Satan to keep men from a knowledge of the Scriptures as he has in former days. And they said, in America, we're not going to let the old deluder keep us out of the Scriptures. We're starting public schools. So this required that when you got 50 people into a community, you had to build a public school. When you got 100 people in the community, you had to hire a teacher for the public school. And the whole purpose of public school is to make sure our kids know the Bible so that we don't get off into the civil atrocities they had in Europe with the Inquisition and Crusades and et cetera. I mean, that's education in America.
Well, again, we're coming back to the question. If this is the root and it was so dominant, then how did we get away?
We got away from it because we allowed ourselves to be put in a tiny little box. When we start, I guess the here's the analogy. How can you have a generation of people that go through Egypt, see all the mighty hand of God, the mighty miracles of God, all the things he did to bring them out of Egypt, and 40 years later they've forgotten who God is? How can you do that in 40 years?
That's
and then
good
God brings them back to himself, and 40 years later they've forgotten again. And then God brings them. And that's
well,
what
I can even say
is.
That it was within 2 or 3 days of passing over the Red Sea
exactly.
that they were saying, you know,
they've
to
forgotten.
God, we had died in Egypt.
If you do not make a point of returning to and diligently paying attention to the things that went before, you forget them and you move in a different direction.
And so you're saying that the church is the first place that dropped the ball because mm-hmm. we withdrew from the public arena because there were issues that were hard to reconcile, lot of controversy, and the church just didn't engage.
We got a lot of criticism. A lot of people started criticizing us, and we didn't like being criticized, and so we'll just get out so you guys don't criticize. My gosh, if you can drive Christians out by criticizing them, man, they'll never stop criticizing. They can put us back in the closet somewhere, and we'll never come out to see light. I mean, you got to be able to step up like Elijah did and say, come on, bring it on. You know?
Well, if criticism would kill you, both of us would be dead.
We'd be dead long ago.
We were talking over lunch about some of the blogs and the
right.
books and people that have
you
spent millions of dollars right. trying to discredit you.
But if you let that intimidate you, then the influence you can have with the history, with the documents, you've pulled that out of society. And the enemy knows that. And so if they can get you backing up, you know, what? In Washington, D.C., we have the National War College. And the National War College is a significant place because people come there from across the world because America has been one of the most successful military nations in the history of the world. We win more wars when we get involved. When you look at the 9 principles of war, defense is not one of the principles of war. Offense is. They say that defense is a temporary time where you reorganize to go back on offense. The church gets on defense. We get defensive and we get attacked. And rather than being on the offense and rather than saying, hey, we need to get involved in education, we need to get involved in law and government, but we need to be involved in Hollywood. We need to be making better movies. We need better newscasters on the nightly news. Hey, we need better everything. We say, you know, we got to defend our faith here.
And you
can't do that.
Since the secularization of the United States is when we have faltered in wars, such
right.
as the Korean, the Vietnam,
that's
Afghanistan.
Right. That's right.
All of these because the moral fiber of the nation doesn't have the commitment.
When you look at secular nations going to war, I mean, in World War II, when we did D-Day in World War II, President Roosevelt led the nation in a 6.5-minute prayer on national radio.
Wow.
And at the time we went to war, to D-Day, Eisenhower stood with the troops and prayed before he sent them out on D-Day. Now, we'd never do that today. That might offend somebody. Look at the difference between wars then against enemies in World War II and where we've been in recent times. And there is a distinct difference.
Sure. And supernatural intervention of God. I mean, documented how
Absolutely.
He intervened. Things worked that couldn't have worked.
Absolutely. Because we used to know that it wasn't in our own flesh that we trusted. You know, in Exodus 15, it's not the power of the horses or the strength of the chariot. It's in the Lord our God. And when we called him to help us, he was happy to do it. But when we said, hey, you keep over there, separation church and state, we can fight our battles by ourselves. We go, not turning out quite the same.
Yeah, you go to kicking God out of your national public life, and then all of a sudden we have had the biggest challenges and failures. I don't know if failure is the right word in wars and conflicts.
And by the way, that's not a discredit to our soldiers because we've got a bunch of great guys out there.
I fought in Vietnam, but you know what? I guarantee you that was we weren't free.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I could look and see the Ho Chi Minh Trail and see them driving trucks down the Ho Chi Minh Trail carrying weapons that they were going to fire at me, but we couldn't fire
at them.
They were out of bounds.
That's right. That's right.
And that's because of the moral or
the lack
of
moral sense. You lose your common sense. God really does give sense. He gives wisdom. And you stop asking God for help and you quit getting the wisdom. And it gets really illogical in a hurry.
I'll tell you what, if we could return to these moral roots and not only individually, but then start expounding them in the public market and stuff, we could see our nations turn around. Not only this nation.
Any nation.
But any nation.
Any nation.
And that's one of the reasons that we're showing this to all of you around the world. I know that, you know, we're celebrating the 4th of July in the United States. And because of that, we're doing some, I guess you'd say, patriotic things. But really, it's not patriotic. We're just talking about God and about how that our faith should be more than just, it shouldn't end at our nose. It ought to influence us in our dealings with other people and in our relationships with other people through government. So that's the reason that we've had these programs on. And once again, I just want to stress that this series that David has produced, and this is only a small portion of what he has. He has a lot of materials, much more than this. But this is 26 half-hour segments that cover everything that we've talked about. He has a lot of documentation. He shows the original documents. It's very well produced. And I tell you, this is a must. You aren't going to learn this in the secular market. That's one of the reasons that I'm using this platform that God has given me to share these truths with you. And we're sharing it around the world. This is being seen in every place in the world right now. And whether you are an American or whoever, if you are a Christian, you ought to grab hold of these truths and start applying it in your world that you live in. And it'll set people free wherever you live. So remember that we have this entire series, 26 half-hour segments on this by David Barton. You can call or write the numbers that you see on your screen and make sure that you join us as we continue this teaching on the gospel truth.
Today's discussion between Andrew and David Barton, titled God and Country, is available in a two-part DVD album as seen on TV. This program, in which Andrew and David discuss America's moral, religious, and constitutional heritage, will be a valuable addition to your personal DVD collection. It's available for a gift of $15 or more. Request DVD album T3505D when you contact us. The second DVD, titled God and Country Part 2, is available for a gift of any amount. We encourage everyone to give, but if you're simply unable to afford it, Andrew and his partners will provide this second DVD free of charge. Request DVD T3505-D2 when you write or call, and we'll be pleased to send it to you. We're also making David Barton's DVD set titled The American Heritage Series available to you. You can have this informative and educational 10-DVD set for a gift of $80 or more. Request item TM233D when you contact us.
Again, I would like to just stress that the materials that we are talking about are in this series right here, the American Heritage Series, and this is by David Barton. There's 26 half-hour segments in here, and I've watched, I think, 10 of these, and I tell you, they are powerful. I have learned more concerning the godly heritage of America through watching this than I've learned in my 60 years just learning things on my own. It is tremendous. It'll help you. David has shared the cost of this. He's cut his price to us by 50%. So as you give and get this series, it'll be going towards David. Also to help us with these programs, I encourage you to get this series today.
You can use your credit card to order by telephone. Our helpline number is 719-635-1111. Helpline hours are from 4 a.m. until 9:30 p.m. Mountain Time. Again, that number is 719-635-1111. Or you can reach us through our website where you can order ministry materials online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at awmi.net. If you prefer to write to us, our address is Andrew Womack Ministries, P.O. Box 3333, Colorado Springs, 80934. Your gifts help Andrew bring the almost too good to be true news of the gospel into countless homes every day. We appreciate your generosity. We hope to hear from you today. Coming to Caris Bible College this fall, the School of Worship and Music Ministry with Charlie and Jill LeBlanc.
The blending of our ministries together, what a joy for us, because to work with a ministry like Andrew and Jamie that love God's Word and they love worship. Let the Word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing in psalms and hymns and in spiritual songs. The teaching of the Word of God that we've sat under in the Andrew's ministry has really influenced our writing so much.
We have just added a brand new dynamic to our Caris Bible College, and that is that Charlie and Jill LeBlanc, who have been traveling with me for many years, and they have now joined up with our Caris Bible College to open up a school of worship and music ministry. And I tell you, they are powerful, and there's just so many things that they've learned in like 30-something years of ministry that they're going to be able to impart into people's lives.
New this fall at Caris Bible College, the School of Worship and Music Ministry with Charlie and Jill LeBlanc. Call or write for more information.
This is a government proclamation. It's printed by the state printer, the governor printer. The prayer request here in Massachusetts, John Hancock, has been praying and fasting that if there's anyone in the state that does not know Christ, that they will come to know Christ in a personal manner. Now, that's a governor on a state proclamation calling for that, and yet, oh no, we have a bunch of godless founding fathers.
Today, the ACLU would sue them.
Oh, absolutely. Do you know that by 1815, they had issued 1,400 government calls to prayer? 1,400 by 1815. 1,400 times they had called the nation, the state, whatever, to prayer.